From the Sky News Centre at 5, thousands of homes have been evacuated along the east coast of England amid severe flood warnings. Charlie Maggs reports.
Thousands of people face spending the night in community centres. Many have been reluctant to leave, but these people in Essex think it's right to be cautious.
I suppose it's better to be safe than sorry.
The same thing happened 3 years ago, and it did come up to the seawall, didn't breach the seawall.
Toby Willison from the Environment Agency explains the risk.
Very high spring tides, which we'll see this evening. Very strong northwesterly winds causing a surge down the east coast.
Parts of the country are also on alert for snow and ice.
Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn's denied losing control of his party after the resignation of MP Tristram Hunt. The former Shadow Education Secretary insists he has no desire to rock the boat, but has been a vocal critic of Mr Corbyn. Meanwhile, there's speculation his Stoke-on-Trent constituency could be targeted by new UKIP leader Paul Nuttall. Its chairman is Paul Oakden.
Paul Nuttall would make an incredibly good candidate, but we have lots of members who would make incredibly good candidates. The wonderful thing is that we now have a very united party. We're re-galvanised, we're rejuvenated, and we're looking forward to hitting a constituency that overwhelmingly voted for us to leave the European Union.
More than 4 in 10 hospitals in England declared a major alert in the first week of the year, meaning patient safety was at risk. 222 serious alerts were issued in the 6 days to last Sunday, around 6 times higher than the period before. Buckingham Palace says the Queen's been told her former brother-in-law has died. Lord Snowden, who used to be married to the late Princess Margaret, was 86. In football, it's understood West Ham paid midfielder Dimitri Payet a £1 million loyalty bonus in September. The French international is now refusing to play for the club. And Drake has rescheduled some of his UK tour dates. He was due to perform in London and Glasgow this month, but the dates have now been put back until March. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news. As Green councillor for Frome, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too, along with Shane Collins. After the 6 o'clock news, senior political attaché at the Israeli embassy, Shai Masor, is recorded by Al Jazeera planning to remove or take down junior defence secretary Alan Duncan. So why does it take a TV network from the Gulf state of Qatar to do what the London media and the security service MI5 should be doing? Also, was all that stuff about Russia hacking the US election fake news or not? We speak to someone who was in the middle of the story. And talks about the reunification of Cyprus, healing the wounds made by the man behind the bloody Turkish invasion in the 1970s, Henry Kissinger. They hinge these talks on energy resources. Why is that? And nearly a week after we reported it here, the London media finally catch up with news of Operation Atlantic Resolve, Obama shipping 2,000 tanks and 4,000 soldiers to Europe. While moving a further 1,600 tanks from Germany and Holland up to the Russian border. Remember the promises James Baker made to Edward Shevardnadze back in 1990? Well, NATO doesn't seem to remember them at all. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. To our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of minus one, icy and possibly even snow tonight. This weekend, highs of 10 Celsius, so any snow will turn to rain and obviously melt. Saturday progresses and some sunny spells. Cloudy with rain, though, on Sunday. Next week, highs of 5, rain on Monday, after that a cold week with sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 21st and 22nd of January, highs of 7 Celsius and sunny spells again. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Green Councillor for Frome and Mendip District Council, Shane Collins. Hi, Shane. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening. Thank you.
Now, did I get that right? Are you a councillor in Frome for Mendip?
I'm a councillor for the Keyford wards in Frome on Mendip District Council. And I'm one of three new Green councillors that got elected in May last year.
Now, we were talking on this show last week about councillors being almost like official receivers. They're there to just decide where the cuts are going to fall and each month by month, year by year, to do the cuts.
Certainly for district councils and county councils, as the funding changes in the next few years, i.e. the central government grant is going to go completely. It's already 30-40% gone. And then councils will have to get income from their business rates, which they will be able to vary. So the concern is rather like transnational corporation taxes. It will be a race to the bottom, and councils will drop their business rates to try and attract companies in.
And I imagine that there'll be some councils with hardly any business rates at all, and that all of the businesses will try and focus themselves there. I mean, surely this is something that should be central government should be raising this money. Enough to pay for local authorities as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there will be some switch over the Barnett formula where money goes from poorer councils, from wealthier councils to poorer councillors, but how the detail of that happens is not revealed yet. And also, I think it's going to accentuate the difference between councils with good transport links where companies might want to locate, and those like us in Mendip between the M3 and the M4, not quite such good business links.
What about the effect that Hinckley's having? Isn't that going to give a boost to the area around there?
Well, the Leveller magazine, very good local magazine in Somerset, did some research into it. They reckoned out of the total cost of Hinckley, which is now up to about £37 billion, around 400 million of that would actually go to companies in the southwest. The vast majority of it is going to keep France, keep EDF afloat, and it looks like also Japanese Steel and Casting Company, who are currently in such difficulties over their castings for Flamanville, looks like they will also be making some of the parts for the first Hinckley reactor.
Now, I mean, one of the, I wouldn't say it's quite just a rumour, but certainly some of the facts point to the idea that Hinckley's only really being built as the type of reactor it is, that is using this uranium fuel, solid fuel, that because there is this massive industry to keep those kinds of reactors going. And actually there is other technology, even nuclear technology, that would be a lot safer, a lot cleaner, but then they're not plump for that because there's this enormous industry that's desperate to kind of self-perpetuate.
It's very confusing. The starting point is that onshore wind is now reckoned to be 22% cheaper than nuclear. Offshore wind is reckoned to be 8% cheaper than nuclear, and solar PV 4% cheaper than nuclear. That's now. So that surely answers all the questions you need to know. Hinckley is not going to be economic. It's an expensive way to keep...
People don't want these great loads of windmills all over the hills, do they? They don't mind a few here and there, but they certainly don't want their views of the Mendips completely destroyed by loads and loads of windmills. I mean, you'd have to have thousands, probably tens of thousands of those, in order to do one Hinckley power station.
You'd certainly have to have a lot, but there's a lot of windmills, but offshore, onshore, and then underwater tidal turbines. There's a load of different ways you can do it, but the actual net result is that it is cheaper energy than nuclear, and to me that should be the key thing. But as you point out, post Brexit, it looks like there's a degree of kowtowing to the Chinese and to the French, because we want trading partnerships with them after Brexit, but I can only see trouble ahead.
Martin Summers, you worked on the sort of economics of the nuclear industry, haven't you, in the past? I think, was it at the New Economics Foundation?
Yeah, well, I wrote a sort of summary paper for them a long time ago about the economics of it. And the main thing about that was, of course, that it was in the 1980s that the Tory government wanted to privatise the nuclear industry. And there was all sorts of talk about it, and the City of London were getting all excited. And then they looked at the books and said, oh, no way, we don't want to touch this. Because it's only really viable with government subsidy of one kind or another. And of course, the problem is you then get to path dependency in the French society has become addicted to nuclear power. They've spent an awful lot of money on developing it, and once you've done that, it becomes uneconomic to undo that. So having made those decisions, you're then stuck with them, and it then becomes an imperative to sell on your nuclear technology to others to defray the expense to yourself. And also, another thing I'd just mention about this, in the 1970s, they're using pressurised water reactors in France, and there was a major drought in 1976, some of us may remember. And at that point, they had to close down all of the nuclear industry because they didn't have enough water and the water table for the reactors. So there you are, this massive technology which supposedly liberates you from the dependence on nature, and in actual fact, a drought can close it down.
You haven't got that problem at Hinckley, and also, of course, you're in Frome, which is quite a few hills in between you and Hinckley, so surely it's not really going to affect you much.
Well, Frome is, what, about 50 miles away from Hinckley, so that's about half an hour on the wind, depending upon how big the wind is, and we still haven't got our iodine tablets anywhere in Somerset other than 2 miles within Hinckley. So if there's an accident, it would certainly affect us very quickly. But the main reason it affects us now is that there is basically a choice between renewables and fracking in Hinckley, and the government has gone for fracking in Hinckley. So that vastly affects the price for electricity that we will be paying in the future. The strike price for Hinckley is twice the current rate of electricity. So whilst the price of electricity has been going down because of renewables, we're going to be paying double the current price for the next 35 years. And to whom? We're going to be paying it to EDF and their Chinese partners, the Chinese General Nuclear Corporation and CNNC, both wholly unsuitable partners. I mean, let's talk about them for a moment. EDF, 85% owned by the French government. Their shares are in free fall. They've lost a third of their value in the last year. From April 2014 was their high point at 29p per share. Now, in January 27, they're 8.9p per share. So they've gone down, decreased by three times in value. Since they got the deal with Hinckley, their credit rating has dropped, so the interest they pay on a 36 billion euro debt, which is where they currently are, will be going up. The French government is just about to bail them out with 3 billion euros. They're trying to take over Areva, the bankrupted nuclear manufacturer. But Areva and Le Creuset, their forgers, have got huge, huge problems because the castings they've been making for Flamanville and for Hinckley just keep going wrong. They're having carbon segregation, too much carbon in the steel, which makes it brittle under pressure. This is just...
That means that basically, if you get some sort of problem with the reactor, the pressure vessel, rather than holding in all this nuclear nightmare, would just go bang, fracture and go bang. I think we saw that actually at Fukushima. We did see this kind of plume of nasty stuff coming out the top of it. I remember that.
Yeah. EDF, if they're a private company, would probably have gone bust. But because they're owned by the French government, they are sort of hanging in there. But they absolutely depend on the money from the British government to save EDF. They've got 58 nuclear reactors in France. Which a lot of them are suffering from this carbon segregation. They've just had to take 20 of them offline in November to test for carbon segregation. So these reactors are going
to cost... Actually, sorry to interrupt you, but just looking at the latest on those, these ones that they've said, we'll have to test these because they look as if they're dangerous, these reactors, the French government's given them permission to keep using them because it's so cold in France, so they need to keep them on.
Well, yes, with just about half their reactors offline, the price of electricity in Europe over the last couple of months has really shot up. France has had to import lots of energy from Germany and at times from Britain and Spain, where, you know, there are good renewable supplies. So EDF seems like an incredibly unlikely partner. But then the Chinese companies involved... are similarly, well, let's just say there are security concerns. One of these companies is currently charged by the American government with industrial spying. That's the China General Nuclear Power Group. And the other one, the CNNC, their president is currently in jail for corruption, life imprisonment. And they're just, do we really want these people controlling our smart meters in a few years'
time? How's he able to run the business from prison?
Does he have some sort of... I guess he has a mobile phone chucked over the wall. That's how it happens, isn't it? No, I mean, there has been a lot of problems with corruption there.
Martin, I think, you know, there seems to be serious... I mean, we've been looking, obviously, the last years and years at the banking system and many of these banks, and it's only the fact that they are so close to government that has meant that they've been able to continue. They don't really seem to be viable. Seems we've got a similar kind of thing going on with the nuclear industry.
Yeah, I mean, there is the nuclear industry only ever developed on the back of nuclear weapons, really. If there hadn't been a nuclear weapons production, then the nuclear industry would probably never have taken off. And if you remember back in the 50s in Britain, we were told it would be too cheap to meter. Well, it's certainly not the case. And of course, the real problem, the fundamental problem which makes it so expensive, is the waste. Because the waste, I mean, that's why the private sector won't touch it. And I understand, and perhaps Sean can correct me if I'm wrong, that the government is basically taking care of the waste aspect of what's going on. Otherwise, the private sector, even the rubbish private sector we're talking about, wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. Because if they were actually going to have to pay out, if there was any problem with the waste, then it would really make it completely unviable.
That is correct. I mean, it's part of the massive subsidies that the government gives the nuclear industry. I mean, not only looking after the waste, but the nuclear regulatory bodies, which are about £2 billion a year they cost to run, the inspectorate, these sort of things. Yeah, it's huge and massive subsidies, which at the time we're seeing feed-in subsidies for renewables being cut to shreds. It ain't a level playing field at all.
What about the politics at the Mendips and Froome? Because I would imagine most of that part of the country is going to be pretty solidly conservative, rural, fairly wealthy.
Yes, that is definitely the case. Somerton and Froome, the constituency we're in, the towns all vote Green or Lib Dem, but the villages, which are mainly retired people, vote very heavily Conservative. It's not based on any politics, I don't think, and certainly if you talk about nuclear, most people have got any idea about it, don't want it at all.
Yeah, we've been hearing a lot about the health service this week, and we will hear a bit more. But how's things down in that part of the country?
In terms of the health service in Somerset? I don't know, to be honest. We've just got the new health proposals come through, which other people in the local party, ex-NHS workers, have done a big appraisal of. But it looks... I mean, having seen that hospital documentary on the BBC the other night... which is on for the next week, I think that is really going to put the cat amongst the pigeons.
Okay, what was that, a panorama or something?
No, it was. It's called Hospital, it's at St Mary's Hospital in London, and it's just looking at, the main thing that came across to me, that it was these massively specialised doctors, professors, surgeons, who couldn't operate because there wasn't any beds to put people into after the operations, and it all comes back to the fact that Britain, compared to France and Germany, and have about half the number of hospital beds per 1,000 head of population. And NHS is always going to be in problems when we just don't spend nearly as much on the NHS, and in particular beds per 1,000 people, as the rest of Europe.
Well, this seems like a really good documentary series. Just dialing it up here, it's on the BBC iPlayer, and it's just episode one so far. I imagine there's some more of those to come.
Yeah.
The dates, I think that's that was on Wednesday. So it's on Wednesday evenings, although it doesn't say on the iPlayer what time of the evening it is. So I imagine that'll be on again next week.
So the other thing we're trying to do for the people of Somerset, in fact, people all over Britain, as part of our campaign to stop EDF or to switch them off, just push them a little bit further over into bankruptcy, we're bribing people. If you are an EDF customer, or if you're a customer with any nuclear supplier, i.e. British Gas, quite a few other ones, we will pay you up to £40 to switch away from nuclear to good energy or eco-electricity. Because, you know, we make our vote every month with whoever we support with our electricity bills. If you're with EDF, you are supporting a nuclear future for the next 150,000 years for future generations to deal with. So we will pay you £20 per fuel, £20 for gas, £20 for Leckie, £40 in total, to switch away from EDF or any other nuclear suppliers and go to EcoTricity or Good Energy. All you do is go to www.switchedfoff.org.uk, fill it in there, and we will send you £40 for moving your dual fuel over. We've given up a logical argument. It's bribery now, girls and boys.
I think, actually, that a lot of these markets, post-privatisation market, Martin, they are actually about that, aren't they? It's number one is confusion marketing, so it's very difficult for you to actually compare one to another. Mm-hmm. And then the idea is they come along and they say, well, we'll give you this if you join us.
Yeah, well, confusion marketing is. I mean, I have a meter where I am in my private rented accommodation, and I just haven't got the time or the energy to look into all of these things. And in the past, when the industry was nationally owned, then you could actually have a national policy on things like cutting people off and so on. We've created a dog's breakfast.
Is there any prospect, both of you, any prospect of getting back to some sanity here where we're running our electricity services? I mean, we've got this other thing, which is these smart meters coming along, which I just call them stupid meters, because it means that potentially you can be hacked from anywhere on the planet. Potentially, of course, it's Vladimir Putin will be personally behind it, almost certainly. But you could be switched off by a hacker. I mean, why on earth would anyone want to have a meter that will do that to their home?
Well, yes, we have the China General Power Company, who is accused of industrial espionage by the United States at the moment, who we are proposing to give access to. This whole smart meter rollout, it has got all the makings of a huge government infrastructural problem going massively, massively wrong.
It's
currently budgeted
at
about £18 billion. And the government is asking each electricity company to come up with their own smart meter design. So there are huge concerns about compatibility if you want to switch in the future.
So they can sack people, isn't it? So that people can't work. There's no jobs in going around checking the meter once a year or once every 6 months or whatever. That seems to be what's behind this.
There's part of that. I mean, there certainly are advantages to it. It will be in the future, a lot cheaper to use electricity at night. And that these smart meters may be able to help do that. It's also useful for individuals.
But sure, you
to
don't
know
need a smart meter to know whether it's night or day or not. Surely.
To know if the price of electricity, if there's less being used, so it might be cheaper to put your washing machine on after 11 o'clock, yeah, rather than in the daytime. But it also, they do, well,
it's really good in a block of flats when your neighbours put their washing machine on at 2 a.m. That's really handy.
Yeah. There are basic smart meters you can buy for £20 now that tell you how much energy you're using at the time. And that's what these more advanced smart meters will do, but a whole load of other things as well.
A&E crisis deepens this week with 66 hospital trusts issuing emergency alerts. This is Laura Donnelly in the Telegraph today. Official data from NHS England reveals 66 hospital trusts have issued warnings. They're under heavy pressure, including 8 which declared a high state of emergency at some point. Total, almost half the hospitals in England declared major alerts in the first week of the year. 66 of 142 trusts issued operational pressure alerts. As bed shortages intensified and A&E departments became overwhelmed, overall NHS hospitals issued 226 serious alerts in 6 days, saying they're experiencing major pressures. Total of around 376,000 attendances at A&E during the week, which was up 372,000 from 372,000 in the previous week. Earlier this week, Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt urged the public to keep away from A&E unless absolutely necessary. He said up to 1 in 3 visits could have been avoided with help should have been sought elsewhere. Latest disclosures followed tensions between Number 10 and Simon Stevens, the head of the NHS, who is to blame for this crisis. During a select committee on Wednesday, Stevens said Theresa May was stretching it to say the NHS had been given more money than it asked for. He also denied her suggestion the crisis was partly being caused by poor management of hospitals by saying the hospitals were not feckless. Downing Street officials responded angrily, pointing out Mr. Stevens had given a fulsome welcome to a £10 billion pound NHS cash boost when it was awarded. It follows also claims by the British Red Cross, interesting to see them getting involved as well, that the hospitals are facing a humanitarian crisis. Earlier this week, the Prime Minister said the description was irresponsible of the Red Cross and overblown. Martin, I mean, things are going from bad to worse. If you look at, we've got a clip coming up a little bit later from this chap who's a former chair of an NHS trust. His name's Roy Lilly, and he's saying effectively the NHS has been subsisting on the same amount of money every year since 2010, and yet they're a fantastic amount more, something like 5-6%, maybe more than that, that it's having to do on the same amount of money.
Well, we don't spend as much money on our healthcare as other European countries, as Sean pointed out, although the NHS in fact is the most efficient system for providing healthcare. It's not an insurance-based system. That actually makes it more efficient. All the evidence shows that. And the fundamental problems are to do with the structure of the NHS, because we shouldn't really have hospital trusts which can go bust. That's silly. And the other thing, of course, that's causing huge problems is the budget for social care, which has actually been devolved to local authorities, has been cut, and that means that people can't leave the hospital because there's nobody to look after them when they go home. And they're now saying, well, local authorities can raise council tax in order to provide social care. And it's, you know, there's no joined up thinking about how to deal with all of this.
Yeah, what do you make of all this, Shane? What's going on?
Yes, well, certainly the county councils can raise some money. The government has allowed the council tax to go up by 3% without a referendum, but there is no way that that small increase is going to allow county councils to take care of social care at all. There is absolutely no doubt about that. That SOP will not work. It needs far, far more central government funding for social care to ameliorate the current bed-blocking situation.
So let's have a listen now to Roy Lilly. He's a chappie who's a former NHS board chair, and he's also quite a prolific author. His most recent book is called Your Health and the Internet. And I mean, of course, you know, it's quite interesting. There's an amazing amount of information out there online about health. So the question is, sometimes patients will turn up at their doctors knowing more about what's wrong with them than they will. So anyway, let's have a listen to Roy Lilly now. And he's really pulling apart this whole, you know, what is going wrong with the funding for the health service, having said that the funding has stayed the same. It's been flatlining effectively since 2010. Funnily enough, that's when the coalition government came in. And now he says it's reached a kind of tipping point.
Theresa May is right. There's always a winter crisis. The trouble is the winter crisis used to be from about sort of November to the end of February. But now it's been for the last 2 years, we've had a winter crisis in August because the demand's gone through the roof and everything's choked up. What could she do? Well, look, what everybody was asking Chancellor Hammond to do in the autumn statement was to put some money into social services. The NHS actually was saying, look, if there is any money around, don't give it to us, give it to social services. So he could have made an adjustment in the allocation to social services. And I mean, okay, yeah, you know, the money's got to come from somewhere and it is our taxes, but there's all kinds. There's contingency funds and you can move money around government. I mean, government isn't broke. I mean, it does have money. It just got to decide to choose where it wants to spend it. If it had put money into social services, I think we wouldn't be facing a half of the problems we're facing now. Now, the other issue is that Sajid Javid, who is the community secretary, recently announced that local authorities will be allowed to adjust what they call the precept. Now, the precept is the amount of money councils can raise locally to help pay for social care. What he said was that he would allow councils to increase the The precept as it stands at the moment, which is 2%, he said you can raise it up to 3% for 2 years. Now, here's what is the kind of irritating bit in all this. The original precept was 2% for 3 years, so that's 6% in total. Javid said, oh no, you can raise 3% per year for 2 years, so it's still 6%.
Right.
And I mean, that's what irritates people. And you know, if you were to say to me, well, you know, what is Theresa May's game in all this? I've been sort of a policy watcher since 1974 in the NHS, and I think I've seen it all. But I've not seen anything like this, where the Secretary of State the other day said there are one or two hospitals having a problem. You've just announced, just before the news, the latest occupancy and problems that have just come out from NHS England, where you know, as near as damn it, half of hospitals can't cope. So why there is this denial in the face of the blinding obvious? I mean, mixed video. I could take you now and we could, you know, do a video on our iPhone into just about any hospital.
Well,
and it would be the same.
That was Roy, gosh, what's his name? Roy Lilly, speaking on BBC Five Live earlier on today. He was referring to a video there that is on the Five Live website of just what is the situation like in accident and emergency, with whole loads of people effectively being treated on beds, but those beds haven't actually got a ward to go in. They're just sort of shoved along the sides of corridors. It's getting to the point as almost as if the NHS is dying, Shane.
Well, it's sort of how one's reminded of how to prepare an industry for privatisation. You know, you underfund it. Lots of bad stories go out in the press about individual things going wrong. The service gets a bad name, and then, hey presto, the solution is privatisation. And we've already seen part privatisation through the private finance initiative, which have meant that loads of hospital trusts are paying probably 30% more than it would cost doing it other ways by having to pay ridiculous interest fees to these private companies who've come up with the money, built hospitals, which we will be paying for, which the trusts will be paying for 20, 30 years. So it's bringing the profit motive into the health service, which started two governments ago and has really been continued recently, and it's appalling. Now we're having Virgin Health taking over county departments of social security. I mean, of social security and care. It's frustrating. It really is, because it needs more funding. It needs more beds. But the solution we're being given is more privatisation.
Well, that whole PFI business, you're absolutely right. It's costing an absolute fortune for just here in Bristol, in the North Bristol Trust, for I think it was Liam Nevin, who was finance director up at the NHS Trust up there, who then went straight out of that job to become for a while director of legal services at Bristol City Council, and then he disappeared off the scene. The other major problem is how much the actual NHS market is costing. Now, Martin, we had a piece on here a few weeks ago about that. This is back in March 2014 on BBC Radio 4. Dr. Jackie Davis from the think tank Reform was saying that we're wasting £10 billion a year just at setting up this market. That's just operating the market. And it's a system that nobody wants apart from the private sector.
Well, it was a systematic way of undermining the principles of the NHS. As a socialist, I would argue that certain things are best planned top down, and that in actual fact, the idea of having local, you know, this is a scam. You suggest we're going to have local flexibility and these NHS trusts are going to be independent of government. What happens if an NHS trust goes bust, like Southern Cross, the care homes? Well, in that case, the government's going to have to step in, and it's going to cost an awful lot more. And of course, the Labour government for 13 years were quite happy to have PFI, because what it meant was that the money spent didn't appear on the books as government expenditure. And of course, it's a totally ridiculous and expensive way to fund things. But of course, there was a conspiracy between New Labour and the City of London to do it in that way. So it's not just a Tory matter. It's become a kind of general failing of our politics.
Anyway, Prime Minister Theresa May on Monday this week combined an attack on inequalities in Britain in her speech with a look at mental health in the country. And here's a little excerpt now from her speech, and we'll be hearing a sort of Jeremy Corbyn a little bit later, who did his reboot too. And I'll try and give them equal time, which is not what the BBC did. The BBC gave Jeremy Corbyn about a quarter of the amount of time of his speech on air than they gave to Theresa May.
We live in a country where, if you're born poor, you will die on average 9 years earlier than others. If you're black, you're treated more harshly by the criminal justice system than if you're white. If you're a white working-class boy, you're less likely than anybody else in Britain to go to university. If you're at a state school, you're less likely to reach the top professions than if you're educated privately. If you're a woman, you're likely to be paid less than a man. If you suffer from mental health problems, there's not enough help to hand. If you're young, you'll find it harder than ever before to own your own home. There are not easy answers to these problems, but it is vital that we come together to address them, for they are all burning injustices that undermine the solidarity of our society and stunt our capacity to build the stronger, fairer country that we want Britain to be. But the challenges don't end there. Governments have traditionally been good at identifying, if not always addressing, such problems. However, the mission I have laid out for the government, to make Britain a country that works for everyone and not just the privileged few, goes further. It means more than fighting these obvious injustices. It means acknowledging and addressing the everyday injustices that too many people feel too. Because while the obvious injustices receive a lot of attention, with the language of social justice and social mobility a staple of most politicians today, the everyday injustices are too often overlooked. But if you're from an ordinary working class family, life is much harder than many people in Westminster realise. The injustice you feel may be less obvious, but it burns inside you just the same. If you have a job, but you don't always have job security, you have your own home, you worry about paying the mortgage, you can just about manage, but you worry about the cost of living and getting your kids into a good school. You're putting in long hours with little time for yourself, working to live and living to work. You give work your all, but there's still little left over at the end of the month to spend on the things that really matter to you. Your wages have stagnated for several years in a row, and you feel you're getting by, not necessarily getting on. And at the same time, over recent years, these people have felt locked out of the political and social discourse in Britain. If they voiced their concerns, their views were shut down. Decisions made in faraway places didn't always seem to be the right decisions for them. They saw their community changing, but didn't remember being consulted or agreeing to that change. They looked at the changing world, the onset of globalisation and the advances in technology, and worried about what the future held for their children and grandchildren.
Martin, Theresa May is making a really good job of spelling out what's so difficult for people, and then it was almost maddening. You know, she's talking there about life is getting harder, injustice, insecurity with your job, insecurity with your home. But she really talks about dealing with it all is about dealing with mental health. She's not really, and also when she talks about that, she's not actually offering in her speech this week any more money to look after mental health. So it's, what exactly is going on? Because it almost seems as if she's putting there a catalogue of her own party's injustice without actually saying what she's going to do to get rid of those massive divide between rich and poor.
Well, that's right. But, I mean, the rhetoric is to be welcomed, I suppose. It's about time we started talking seriously about these things. But at the same time, of course, what we need is a more equal society, more equal outcomes, not just equal opportunity to get ahead and become a multi-million pound businessman like her husband, who's very, basically engaged in tax evasion and all the rest of it. So when she says that many people in Westminster don't know what it's like to be working class on low wages, that certainly doesn't include her. But at least the rhetoric's changed. But the point of that, of course, is to cover up the policies that are going to be pursued, which will actually compound many of the injustices that she's mentioning. For example, just off the top of my head, it's the Conservative Party still committed to selling off social housing to existing tenants, which will actually make it much more difficult for people on low incomes to find anywhere decent to live. And that policy has not been changed. It was pushed into the Tory manifesto. It's going to cause all kinds of problems in Bristol and elsewhere. And she would probably say, well, that gives people a chance to buy their own homes. But those homes belong to all of us, and ultimately the housing stock available to people on low incomes is denuded away. And we've got a situation now where people cannot find anywhere to live, and if they can't find anywhere to live, they're unlikely to be registered to vote. The electoral system doesn't work in favour of people in inner cities. We're going to have a new parliament which is going to have only 600 MPs, which means that the existing electoral registers will be used, so people who are outside the system won't be registered, and then the constituency boundaries will be drawn up on that basis. So I think there's an awful lot of hypocrisy in what she said, but hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue.
Shane, you're a Green Party councillor, Froome, at Moore Mendip District Council. Do you think there's any chance of Theresa May creating a country that works for everyone, as she says there?
It was quite strange listening to that, and then one sort of the thought then, but all the policies that she and the Conservative Party have been pursuing for the last 10 years are, that's the result. The state we're in is the result of it. So it's hard to see things changing, and we are entering turbulent and changing times generally. I mean, I think the huge increase in battery storage and how that's going to mean for driverless cars, electric cars, is extraordinary. Just reading about the last few weeks, in 9-10 years' time, we probably won't see an electric, a diesel or a petrol car being sold. They will all be electric by then, all new ones. Which
powered by Hinkley Power Station.
Well, no.
Would it be on stream by then?
Hinkley definitely will not. I mean, I seriously don't think Hinkley is going to be built. There are still numerous problems in the way. Firstly being, there isn't a design that is approved. Flamanville, which is the same reactor design, has been stopped. They have to go back to the drawing boards and make new pieces. The French nuclear regulatory body have said, have another go, chaps. So there isn't a working design, and if there isn't one by the end of 2020, then the British government's guarantees to EDF don't start kicking in. There's still a court case in Europe over state subsidies to EDF from Britain. There's a court case from EDF trade unions taking the boss to court because the day before the French EDF board decision to go ahead with Hinkley, the chairman forgot to tell the board that Theresa May had just put it on hold the day before. So it was a very close decision anyway with the EDF board, but they were fed the wrong information. Added to which, nuclear is simply more expensive than renewables. So one lives in hope that sense will be seen by even the most diehard conservatives, and it won't be happening in 2025.
What we just heard from Theresa May was on Monday. On Tuesday, it was Jeremy Corbyn's turn to reboot his policy agenda.
In the last budget, there was not a penny extra for the NHS or social care. But under the Tories, there's always billions available for giveaways to the very richest. As far as Labour is concerned, the referendum result delivered a very clear message. First, that Britain must leave the EU and bring control of our democracy and our economy closer to home. Second, that people would get the resources they were promised to rebuild the National Health Service. Third, that people have had their fill of an economic system and an establishment that works only for the few, not for the many. And finally, their concerns about immigration policy would be addressed. Labour accepts those challenges that the voters have given us. Unlike the Tories, we will insist on a Brexit that works, not just for city interests, but in the interests of all. That puts health and social care, decent jobs and living standards first, and a better deal for young people and the areas of this country that have been left behind for far too long. First, we will open the way to rebuilding our National Health Service by ending the underfunding and privatisation of healthcare. Leaving the EU won't free up the £350 million a week that Boris Johnson claimed, but savings could be a help in closing that gap. And we will absolutely reject pressure to privatise public services as part of any settlement, just as we oppose the attempt to give special legal privileges to corporate interests as part of the European Union's Canadian-European trade arrangements or the transatlantic trade and investment partnership deals that are being negotiated at the present time. The government could have given the National Health Service the funding it needs, but it chose not to. Their tax giveaways and to big business hand back £70 billion between now and 2022. That is more of a priority to the Tories than elderly people neglected in their homes, patients dying on trolleys, or millions waiting in pain to get the treatment they need. Labour, us, we, created the National Health Service, and it's only safe under a Labour government. We're absolutely clear about that. We will give the NHS the funding it needs. The British people voted to refinance the NHS, and we will deliver it. Second, we will push to maintain full access to the European market to protect living standards and jobs. But we will also press to repatriate powers from Brussels so the British government can develop a genuine industrial strategy essential to the economy of the future so that no community is left behind. Tory governments have hidden behind EU state aid rules because they don't want to intervene. They did so again last year when the steel industry was in trouble and Redcar was closed. Other governments in Europe acted and saved their industry. The Tory government here just sat back. But EU rules can also be a block on the action that's needed to support our economy, decent jobs and living standards. We will use state aid powers in a drive to build a new economy based on new technology and green industries of the future.
That's Jeremy Corbyn on Tuesday with an attempt at a reboot. It was called a bit of a car crash, but in fact, if you go on online and have a look, there's hardly a single positive comment about it at all anywhere, Martin. And of course, Tristram Hunt today has kind of negatively endorsed Corbyn again by saying, well, I'm not interested in politics anymore. I'm going off for a job at the Victoria and Albert Museum.
Yes, private school educated Tristram Hunt. Type of posh chap.
Well, you can't blame him, really, can you, for going to private school? I mean, that's infantile.
But he's no Nye Bevan, let's put it that way. And he joined the Labour Party and became a prominent in the Blairite era. And if those people want to go off and do something else, perhaps it is time they went and did something else.
But what about the more substantive points that Jeremy Corbyn's making there about things like state aid? I mean, this is one, at least he's finding something positive to say about Brexit, isn't he? If we get Brexit, then we don't have to follow these EU rules anymore, which tie our hands when it comes to saving things like South Wales steelmaking.
That's quite right. I think there are positives and negatives surrounding Brexit. But if we're going to leave, then we might as well take the positives with it. But we should have a much more interventionist policy. The Tories have now decided under Theresa May that they do want an industrial policy. It's like we've never had one for 20 or 30 years. We don't need one. The market will decide. And they've suddenly decided, well, actually, maybe we do need one. But I tell you, in countries like Norway, they've always had one. And they're much better managed than we are.
Yes. sorry, but
I'm Corbyn.
I mean, it's good to hear him coming out fighting. He did get slagged off in the media for having mixed messages, but actually, I thought he did quite well. One can't disagree with any of the things he was saying there, frighteningly in slightly the same way. You can't really disagree with what Theresa May was saying, but we know that Corbyn has got some slightly more positive answers. But I still have big problems with Corbyn and the Labour Party on two issues, really. Energy. Labour still can't say boo to the goose of nuclear energy. They are still in the pockets of the unions, who seem unable to realise that there's a lot more jobs in renewables than there are in the nuclear industry. So Labour still seem to be wedded to nuclear power, which is very disappointing. And the other thing I'd like to hear them come out in support of is the basic income scheme, the citizens' income scheme. Mm-hmm. We're heading for automation in many, many ways. We talked briefly about driverless electric cars before, but citizens' income scheme, everybody gets a citizen's income rather like a pension or child benefit. Everybody gets it. It can be a tax credit if you're working. But it just gives everybody the mattress to get through what are going to be a fairly difficult transitional decades as we finally move away from fossil fuel and nuclear into renewables. And the basic income scheme is a key way of doing it. And I think Corbyn and Labour are missing a huge trick by not taking it up.
Well, we've got our own cuts, haven't we, this week announced here in Bristol. Just the end of last week was the end of the first consultation. It looks like there's going to be a whole load of other consultations, with the Mayor, Marvin Rees, managing us apparently through that process. But let's have a listen now to the beginning of BBC Points West last night, where they just sort of announced this whole business of, oh, sorry, folks, but we're going to have loads of cuts to services. Some are going to go completely. And by the way, taxes are going up.
Good evening. Council tax will need to rise, but services will be reduced or lost. That's the situation facing Bristol's 450,000 residents over the next few years. The City Council today revealed some of the largest cuts it's ever had to make.
And there was more gloomy news for the city with the announcement that its planned new arena will be delayed even further. Well, let's join our political editor, Paul Bolchop. Paul.
Well, I'm standing beside what has been dubbed by some the Bridge to Nowhere. It's meant to lead across to what's been called Arena Island, the site for that ambitious new project, but it is in trouble. It could end up costing the council millions of pounds more at a time when their finances are in real, real difficulty. Now, today they've been setting out their spending plans for the next 5 years. Overall, the money that all of our councils get from the government is going down. At the same time, demand is rising. That means that councils are having to put up their council tax. Now, services, as we know, are being reduced. Bristol say they've got to save £100 million by 2022. And so there are going to be cuts to services across the board.
From libraries to bins, from parks to buses, Bristol is cutting spending across all departments. More than £60 million will go over the next 5 years, and that won't be enough. Residents will have to pay more. Council tax will rise by nearly 5%, with a similar increase likely the following year.
Cuts from central government are leaving us in a position that we have to take that additional money where we can. The increase in pressure of an elderly population and more children, I think the child population has gone up by something like 15%, is huge on City Council, so people are paying for that.
The mayor, who took over 8 months ago, has described the changes as horrifically unpalatable. The cuts go very wide. Among the bigger hits, £4 million will go from parks. Adult care loses £2.7 million. Libraries are under threat with a £1.4 million cut, and raising car parking charges will bring in an extra million. Plus, there's an end to the free on-street Sunday parking, which was initiated by the former mayor, George Ferguson, in 2012. That may not please drivers.
Martin, this is where the sort of chickens are coming home to roost for Gordon Brown's mess-up in 2008, effectively, isn't it, really?
Well, you're not going to expect me to agree with that. The fundamental problem is the Tories are still cutting taxes for the wealthy. if there is a budget deficit that we've got to get down, and of course we haven't heard much about that of late. It was the most important thing of all. When remember him, George Osborne was around. We probably don't care about that anymore. So we don't have to worry about budget deficit. But in theory, there's a budget deficit. So why is there any case whatsoever for reducing taxes on wealthy people in those circumstances? Because that means that wealthy people are going to be better off, and people who are dependent on council services in Bristol are going to be worse off. That's a straight transfer of wealth and power from the powerless to the powerful, and that's what the Tory government's all about.
Well, it's going to be an overhaul of council property. That's one of the cuts, supposedly. But actually, they're thinking about saving quite a bit. An overhaul of council's property portfolio is going to hopefully save £2.5 million altogether. I suppose that must mean some of them being sold off. But before we hear from Shane on these latest cuts here in Bristol, let's hear what Bristol's Labour Mayor Marvin Rees has got to say.
We need to get a grip of the finances of local government, OK? Whatever was going on, we wouldn't be facing this situation if we had a proper grip. And we've brought in a fantastic finance lead. He's on the senior leadership team. We are going to get a grip. And but we are staying true to our principles, our commitments around housing, around breakfast clubs for primary schools, mental health interventions. In fact, today I've talked about all those three things with our planners about delivering.
I have to say, those are all great. But one of the things that I saw was the Crisis Prevention Fund, which helps really people in tough situations, you know, people who find themselves homeless to get food, electricity, all sorts of stuff. That's been cut by 55%. Mm. I mean, these are just brutal in a way. I mean, surely with the what you just said, that's not really fair, really.
Well, it's a massive challenge. To say it's a massive challenge is too mild, right? But the point we make is if we are going to keep money in one area, we've got to talk about what we're prepared to deprioritise. There are many things we didn't do that we could have done that we've actually saved. I think secondly, we have to move from this idea that local government does everything to actually saying we have a collective responsibility. So, for example, our commitment on breakfast clubs, that's a group of people, churches have stepped up and said, any school that doesn't have a breakfast club, we will step in. So we can mobilise resources in other areas. But if I can just say, it also speaks to a wider political issue here. We cannot, as a city, as a major city, be on the string of Westminster politics saying whether they are or not going to give us resources. We have to have a serious conversation around real devolution of power and real resources, also so we can take control of our future.
Of course, but that's in the long term. So in the short term, Paul highlighted some of the cuts that are coming. What's the cut, if you had to pick one that you dislike the most, that's really would keep you awake at night? What do you want to do the least?
Anything. We have a series of cuts that are going to impact on early intervention. Coming from public health background, I know that tackling health inequalities, making sure that people can sustain their
lives. Children's services being one of those, 1.5 million... you pledged to protect them. Lots of cuts being made on that side.
And this is a pledge we want. We believe in the concept of children's centres. We are committed to protecting the interventions that come about, the investment in parenting, early physical and mental health. That is absolutely essential to the city's future. But what we're doing is we are working out how we can continue to deliver those kind of interventions, both as a city council, but with the health service, with voluntary sector, with community groups as well.
That's Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees speaking on Points West yesterday. Shane, we've got, swinging cuts to implement here, but what would you be doing if you were in his position?
Trying to borrow money to build houses and rent them out. At the moment, that's difficult because of the right to buy. But possible way round that is setting up a sort of arm's length housing housing division, which right to buy isn't relevant for. So that houses people, it will also bring in an income for the council. But overall, the council's hands are very, very tied. Ever since rate capping in the 70s, 80s, councils have been under the cosh from central government. And now central government have cut back things to the council, so it looks like the councils are taking blame for drops in central government funding, which comes back to what Martin was saying, that taxation is going down, and taxation for big companies is very, very easy to dodge. So that's why we're in a big difficult situation, and it's not something that Mendip or Bristol on its own can completely sort out, but there are ways that can be ameliorated.
Martin, breakfast clubs in schools set up by churches, this isn't really going to change a lot, is it?
Well, it's obviously not satisfactory. I mean, obviously, Marvin's got a church background, that's why he wants to involve the churches in his policy. But it is very tricky, as Shane's pointed out.
I mean, it does sound like a giant con to me. I mean, you're being told you've got to pay this tax. You're being strong-armed by the law, effectively. You're going to jail if you don't pay this money, but you're going to get less and less for it.
Well, that's the whole point. And then the Labour Council, or if it was a Green Council, it would be exactly the same, gets the blame for all of this, and therefore, politically, the government gets off scot-free. I mean, that's the bottom line. As a society, we simply don't value the right things. And you could make a case that the major cities should actually refuse to implement the cuts and make central government bring in their own auditors to carry through the cuts.
Isn't it just the case we didn't stand
in the election on that kind of policy.
Isn't it just the case that the City of London are just telling us what to do, and this is part of the deal?
Yeah, well, what's happened is that the crisis of 2008 has been turned. It's not been a
the
crisis
Gordon Brown
for the people
crisis.
At the top.
You fell right into that one, the Gordon Brown crisis. Anyway, well, finally, let's finish on a more positive note. Seven Crossings £3 toll plan from the UK government. Apparently, it's only going to cost you £1.50 to go each way soon over the Severn Bridge.
What a relief that will be. It does beg the question, why did it actually cost anything? Because the initial cost of building the bridge has now been repaid. So why not just let us use it for nothing instead of continue to make just half the amount of money from it?
Well, that's right. I mean, the Sky Bridge was nationalised by the SNP government when they came to power. It was put up by a toll, you know, based as a toll bridge, and they just said, no, we're not having that, we're changing it, and they did.
OK, thanks very much, Shane Collins from Mendip District Council, Green Councillor. After the news, this is the Israelis. Why aren't MI5 doing anything to stop them spying and trying to change the people who are in our government?